We have four main topics. We're going to be talking about the rise of the 493. What the heck even mean? But we'll get there. Has social media broken the stock market? We'll talk a little bit about the Duval property developer statutory management fiasco here in New Zealand. And then lastly, we'll touch on how crypto can potentially solve New Zealand's energy crisis. Yeah, let's get started on number one, the rise of the 493. What the heck is the 493? Is this like a motorway off-ramp or something? Or have we missed something in the investment lingo here?
Let's hope it's not an off-ramp. Let's hope it's an on-ramp because I want it to be a continued good news story. So we've spent a lot of time in the last kind of 12 months talking about the Magnificent Seven. So those big tech stocks, the Google, Tesla, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Apple, and there's one more.
I wasn't paying attention, bugger. I can't pull you up on that last one that you missed.
All right, so the top seven, but then in the S&P 500, there are 493 others. And what's been really interesting over the last couple of weeks, or probably the last 6 to 8 weeks, is we've seen the rise of the 493. The likes of NVIDIA slightly down, Microsoft slightly down. Companies are struggling because of where they are at on the growth trajectory. And then money seems to be transferring into the rest of the market. It's kind of a couple of things, right? So first of all, the Russell 2000, the small cap stocks have had a great run. And then what we're also seeing is the equal weighted S&P 500. So the S&P 500, it's kind of your weighting inside that is based on your market cap or your free float market cap. The equal weighting just gives everyone a 0.2% weighting. So it's not kind of adjusted by size. And that's kind of last week, I think it was, that's also hit record highs, which indicates that this market rally is no longer a tech story. A story about the strength of the US economy and the global economy. And it's a story about what people expect to happen when interest rates go low. And there's some of the strongest sectors that we've seen so far have been things like utilities, all these kind of the REITs, all of these kind of industries that are likely to be big beneficiaries of lower interest rates. And as people are kind of starting to get nervous about where interest rates go and where they're about to head, so rather than take kind of 3.5% on your 10-year money or your 4% on your 5-year money, they're going, you know what, that 5% dividend yield, that's actually starting to look pretty attractive again. And so we're starting to see this rotation as we're moving back from a high interest rate world, back to a lower interest rate world. And that's kind of starting to flow through into the stock market as well.
The saying then about where we're at in the world when it's almost like the boot has been taken off of the neck of the economy, or at least the sentiment change off the back of the promise that the boot will be lifted off the neck of the economy, i.e., hey, are we going to have 0.25 or 0.5 reduction in the Fed funds rate this week? Maybe it's just front running that. So it doesn't necessarily speak yet to the strength of the economy, but more to the sentiment, perhaps. Would that be fair to say?
Look, I think it is very, very sentiment driven. It is really interesting, right? All cap stocks typically do a lot worse. And I think there's a lot of parts of the economy, particularly in that S&P 500, that struggle if we do move into a recession. So on one hand, it is sentiment driven and it is people kind of positioning themselves for the next part of the market. But I do think it is also investors kind of firmly buying in and believing in this kind of no landing story, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something I was listening to last night, which was kind of an interesting take on that, right? But stocks that continue to trade at all-time highs. You know, the story around kind of stock market is you want to sell into a recession. And when you kind of think you're kind of almost at the bottom, or you kind of call it 3 months in, that's at that point that you want to start buying back in. But it's still at high, so there's no selling that's happened yet. They've got gold at all-time highs and just continues to skyrocket. And that's generally a sign of instability. Price, very, very low. And oil futures remain low as well, which is an indication of where demand is expected. And then we've got people pricing in over the next kind of 12, 18 months, about 200, 250 points worth of interest rate cuts, which some would argue it is recessionary. So it's where I find, so I think a long way of saying you're 100% right. It has to be sentiment driven, because the different markets are all telling slightly different stories right now.
Yeah, and I think like why this is really important for us to really get our heads around, but I guess really appreciate, is because of simple principles like diversification, asset allocation, right? Like, we don't really know where the money will flow. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. And so by owning a basket, that's what's so cool about the S&P 500 index, is that you don't actually have to think, which I know feel like a little bit like a lazy way of doing it, but hey, you're still in the market, compounding does its thing. And because of the principles of asset allocation that are kind of inherent in there, and just diversification, things are spread over 500 different baskets. Investors want to be really clever and figure out where the money will flow to next based on where we're at in the economic cycle. Then you already have a position in those other assets just by making that one investment. What are some of the other things, like from your perspective, that you're looking at going, yep, this is exactly why diversification kind of works for most people?
So yeah, the diversification is a really, really important point, right? Because what it's showing is the strategy that's worked really well over the last 3 years probably isn't going to work, is not currently working, right? And so by that, I mean that investing in growth, investing in technology, that's kind of been that bulletproof strategy that's lasted so well for the better part of the last, or ever since COVID, to be fair. Yeah. And that means we're now moving into the kind of what's done well is value. The number one rule in finance is past performance doesn't equal future performance. And an investment strategy that works in one set of market conditions is unlikely to work in the next set of market conditions. So I find it really, really interesting, because you don't really know when those conditions are going to change. You don't really know what's going to happen next. And we've talked a lot in the last couple of months about how markets have been setting themselves up for a big fall for the better part of 2 years. For 2 years, we've been talking about how highly valued tech stocks have been. And so, but at the same time, anyone that's missed out on that trade has missed out on that 30, 40% of returns. So that 100% diversification, having your eggs in all of these little different baskets, is unfortunately the only way that it kind of works. So that you make sure when one market goes, you've got some exposure, or when the next market goes, you don't. And it's not all just about chasing worked over the last couple of months, or kind of chasing those bulls and chasing where it's gone to as well.
It kind of loosely touches on this concept of the efficient market hypothesis, where if one basket over here of certain types of investments like tech versus small cap, if they're starting to pop or not, and these ones aren't, then does that say, hey, well, the information changes? And as the information changes, people account for that information. The market is particularly instant. The price of those types of investments will factor in either the surplus demand or in demand, and it gets reflected in the price. As the speed of information, as the interconnectedness of the information itself is to occur, and the dynamic around how fast prices will change also change, because the speed at which information is moving around and the market can adapt will be so much quicker, or it is so much quicker than perhaps what it used to be. On to our next point around social media. Is it true to say that, hey, social media is effectively in the stock market?
Yeah, so this was an Economist article that was last week talking about a research paper that came out from Investor, and some of the subsequent comments around the article maybe suggest that it's a bit of a bitter and twisted investor that hasn't had a great couple of years. It is really interesting, right? Where over the last kind of 10 years, we've seen the rise of the quant investors. We've seen that people are now making investment decisions within nanoseconds, and it's all about who can be fastest to the market with certain pieces of information. Social media has also done is it's meant that we've got these hordes of retail investors who move together and they move in bulk. And it's no longer a world where the narrative and the messaging is controlled by traditional establishment. It's really, and often what we saw with GameStop, to a certain extent with Tesla, and some of these larger kind of tech stocks, and there's even potential for Nvidia to be included in this, you can get a movement that starts on social media and really drives things a long, long way. Puff comes out of them. I think that this kind of, the research paper was talking about how we've now got a wider dispersion of valuations than we've ever kind of had before. We've got value versus growth premiums. We've got much stronger movements in a lot of these big names we've ever had before. argument is that this is a lot down to social media. A lot of people would also argue this is democratizing the message, and institutional investors no longer like it because they no longer control the movements and control the flows. But it's a really interesting question.
And I think if we think about even just the news cycle that we are in right now, there's interesting stories. There's speculation around the Fed funds rate in the US going down by a 0.25 or a 0.5% amount. It's another assassination attempt on Donald Trump, which was initially just reported as a gunfight. Now it's it was a gunfight between two independent people. Now it's a proper assassination attempt, and I'm sure there'll be another variation. Another story.
It's now gone to the only shots that were fired were actually Secret Service firing shots at this guy. So guy didn't actually fire any shots. The guy was, to be fair,
he's probably just golfing,
of course, with a gun, which is not that unusual in America.
Of course not. No, that don't go outside of your home in Florida without your protection, right?
Exactly.
That is 9 iron, and he had his other iron. That's fair enough. One of the other stories, but it's just interesting to see how the scene. Social media will toss the narrative around a little bit as time goes on, a little bit unclear as to where the true story is. And so while social media speeds up the information flow, which could effectively influence the stock market, even just this example that I came across probably 2 days ago, increasing concerns or suspicions is probably the best way to put this, because I haven't seen any data that would back this up, but increasing concerns, which are being shared by a broader range of people, that Coinbase is effectively issuing her coin or effectively creating units of Bitcoin that don't exist on behalf of BlackRock, which effectively is suppressing the price of coin because of the ETF this year. Now, if you understand a little bit about gold, then this is not an unusual story or a claim. Difficult to prove. It's dangerous sometimes to go too far, perhaps. But this story is going to probably be chewed on for a little bit. It be a conspiracy theory. It might be fact later on. That seems to be kind of the process. Or it might go back to conspiracy theory and be debunked later on, hopefully. But it's just an example, I guess, of how you'll have to run this misinformation or run through the misinformation gauntlet or the fact-checking gauntlet to actually see whether it will be true in the end. So do you think that relates to actual stock prices or the prices of anything that have a market, that the speed of information from social media will just increase volatility more than anything else?
That's right. I think I hadn't thought so much about the quality of the information and the veracity, whether it's true or not, but that's a more important point even than my points around speed and those of retail investors. Because, in the old world, information was fact-checked. Information was verified before it turned out to be true.
Yeah.
Today, you end up in a world where it's not fact-checked. It's just put out there very, very quickly. And actually, it's also done as it's meant that the traditional media pick up on those stories and report on them. They use words like rumors or social media says or Donald Trump says. We know that's never a kind of truth. But
of course, is familiar with the matter, right?
Yeah. The problem with all of that, though, is that actually not only has social media pushed it's kind of pushing the boundaries, but it's forcing traditional media to push the boundaries. And coming back to where we started, right, efficient markets rely on true and accurate information. And if we can't get true and accurate information in the mainstream, or at least people trading on that, then it makes it really, really, really hard.
It makes it hard, but it also unlocks an interesting dimension when we talk about the concept of active versus passive in terms of like a tactical strategy. If you wanted to play, you call it information asymmetry. If you wanted to take a contrarian view on something because you believe one narrative more than the other, and believe it with a high degree of conviction, then because we have a lot more variety with our speed of information that's coming along, there's maybe an opportunity to take these contrarian bets. But again, say it's about the speed, but also the veracity of that. And so as that changes, it's really it all over the show and shake everybody out in the end.
And it's been fascinating over the last 2 years where traditional mainstream street view of what should be happening and what's actually happening in the markets is completely different. I think retail movement, social media narrative are making it really, really hard to go through that. Unfortunately, probably the only business person that truly, truly understands this, Musk. And that's kind of why he's I personally believe that's one of the reasons why he's so active on social media. And he's using Twitter as both a data sourcing kind of hub, so to understand trends, understands what's happening, but he's also using it to make sure that he now 100% controls his narrative. And he no longer needs to kind of have his PR team trying to figure out and make sure that he kind of trying to sell stories, because to be fair, he's got 100 million Twitter followers, and he just gets the message out whenever he needs to anyway, and mainstream pick it up because they know that's what people click on.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so closer to home here, we have probably gone through a property correction. I would pretty safely say that there's been a property correction, especially if you adjust it for inflation. Prop prices have come down by more than 20% in my view, if you actually consider the actual purchasing power. But things are cyclical with property, and it is low tech enough still where you can understand some of the fundamental drivers and look at the cyclical patterns and then adjust an investment strategy or fine tune an investment strategy to benefit from the cycles, the seasons, the property clock, whatever you want to call it. And without fail, whenever there's a down cycle, like when the tide goes out, you can see who's swimming naked, these fall over. Initially, property developers will be the first ones. Maybe it's your builder initially to start with, but then it'll be the big time property developers. We had this kind of unraveling of this story over the past little while, actually, with Duval. I want you just to through that story, and we're now that place of statutory management. So if you could just give us the highlights of that, and what does statutory management even mean?
This would have been 4 weeks ago. So Duval, for the case of anyone, it's a property developer in Auckland, run by the very public and supposedly extremely rich and successful Ken Clark and his wife, but there's kind of been a lot of struggles to pay their debts. They've got a mortgage fund, which has got about $110 million sitting in it. I think that was about just under $100 million of a mortgage fund sitting in it, with about 120 investors in it as well. But kind of, they've been trying to do a whole lot of stuff over the last couple of years, debt for equity swaps. They've been told off by the FMA 3 or 4 times, the regulator, for kind of misleading investors. So there's no question, it was ugly. And everyone's kind of known in the background that they're bust. No one's really done a huge amount about it. Weeks ago, FMA, the Financial Markets Authority, what they did is they recommended to the government to put them into statutory administration. That's then subsequently PricewaterhouseCoopers have been appointed as the statutory administrator. Statutory administration basically comes in over the top and kind of trumps any other administration, liquidation, or any claims by shareholders, creditors, anyone else. What you see as statutory manager basically now have full decision rights around what happened, who gets paid, how they get paid. They might put me into administration. I might look at how they can kind of recover their funds.
Yeah.
The problem is because they've kind of generally got senior security versus others, statutory administration, all of those traditional rights for lenders, creditors, have completely disappeared, and they've been kind of trumped by the statutory administration. Take years and years to work out and figure through. This initially was supportive because I'd kind of been following the Duval story for kind of a couple of years, and you can see it's just it's a clusterfuck, and it never should have been allowed to happen. Now I kind of started to see the other side and did some other interesting reading about it. It's really interesting, right? Statutory administration is something that was developed really, I guess, post-GFC. Tool that the government is able to use to kind of avoid the meltdowns that are going to impact a very, very large group of investors or creditors, or alternatively to kind of that's going to cause systematic risk to kind of the broader economy or the broader financial system. I understood that. I was like, hold on a sec. How can we have total liabilities that are sitting in here of $250 million? And only about 120 investors in this mortgage fund. There are a whole lot of other creditors that are owed quite a lot of money as well. But I guess, does that justify signing off on tipping this thing into administration? Does it justify the fact that we've now taken all of the rights away from banks, the creditors, all of these other people? Let's be honest, pretty small kind of scheme in a pretty small fund. This is much smaller. This is only like the sixth largest developer in the country. kind of the mortgage fund was one of the smaller kind of these types of funds that are out there, had a lot of investors. I'm kind of struggling to see why this is happening, to be really honest, because I think the kind of feels to me as though it's kind of pretty much regulatory overreach. At the same time, it feels a lot as though was the FMA trying to clean up, and kind of they should have stopped this thing years ago and this stuff. Now they're in a world of going, well, we didn't stop it then at the top of the cliff, so we're just going to really make sure that there's a massive road smash at the bottom of the cliff. It's really scary, right? Because I guarantee there are a hell of a lot of other businesses in New Zealand with $250 million of creditors and debt that are in just as much trouble as Duval. Right. Do they now need to be worried that statutory administration is coming? Because, yeah, I think it sets a terrible precedent from the use of this legislation.
And then you have the likes of, say, PwC acting as the FMA, who are making effectively arbitrary decisions, which a little bit unusual, like what you're saying. I'm just trying to reflect back what you're saying.
I don't think it's unusual. I think they are being told what to do, right? But at the same time, I think it was their base. Well, you've also got to remember, right? They're a commercial organization. They got asked for a recommendation. They got said, what should we do here? Do we give them back all their assets and leave it alone and let the banks tip them into receivership? Or do you guys want to do it and put them under statutory administration? If you recommend option two, you're going to make $50,000 a day. If we can amend option one, there's probably no more of a job for you. I think there's a few conflicts, and I'm not, and again, this is a suspicion, but it's amazing that an entity is allowed, and it's kind of one of the issues with our whole kind of receivership and liquidation rules. Yeah, basically, you see it all the time here in New Zealand because of the size of our market and the size of our professional services, where you've kind of got, we'll appoint an independent expert to have a look at something, which is effectively what happened here. Probably when that happens, their independent expert will go, cool, receivership is the answer here. That independent expert picks up on that receivership, they make a couple of million bucks in fees, and they'll move it through into liquidation, which again, sure, they pick up another couple of $1 million in fees. And it's kind of, it is a tough one here. And I see a lot of that. I think the Duval piece is kind of that playing out in the public sphere, but I also just don't understand why or how this justified using statutory administration.
Are you hinting here at corruption?
I don't think it's corruption at all.
Or a corrupt system. I should probably qualify that. Are hinting at a corrupt system, not necessarily actors or organizations that are...
I think we are hinting, or not hinting, I'm saying, I think it is a system that has not been designed to manage conflicts of interest.
Sure.
I think there are kind of inherent conflicts of interest in the system. I'd also suggest that under the Duval world, there is an interesting piece that Cisco actually is the extreme action result of earlier inactivity versus kind of trying to stop broader contagious impacts right now.
Top of all that, I said before also that they're relatively small in terms of property developers, but they were relatively large in terms of how they were showing their wealth. Do you think that there was a little bit of that tall poppy power motivating this as well?
It has to be a big chunk of that, right? And yeah, you look at, say, for example, the Williams Corporation, they've got bigger property funds, they've got bigger developments. They've made it, they've kind of pulled their heads in, they are no longer pretending, they're selling all their assets, knows where that lands. But it is kind of interesting. I do find it, their personalities did have a big chunk of that answer as well. What's wrong? That their personality should not have driven that answer.
Right. And that's where, I guess, systemic point of view, things need to be designed so that they're fit for purpose to execute justice rather than force, which is initiated from anything other than just the facts, right? Has there been a nation of some sort?
Yep.
Yes, this is the process. It should be evenly distributed. There shouldn't be any favoritism or avoiding this or targeting this one to send a message. That kind of feels like sometimes that's what's actually occurring. That's what I'm hearing. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%.
Okay,
So an interesting one. I get that's slightly controversial, but it is, yeah, it's really interesting where this has gone, right? And I guess, well, coming back to our previous topic, all of this has been done for the news cycle and so that regulators and government can show that they're doing something versus actually using the legislation for what it's been designed for.
Yeah, and you do see this for the show, like going back to the U.S. Federal Reserve, the RBNZ out of New Zealand, what they say, what they do are different, and they don't try and hide that. They try to talk the market up or down. So in effect, what they're doing is they're saying that, yes, we do deceive you, and that is actually part of our MO. That's what we do. You to think a certain way so that we don't have to follow through with some of our threats, right? So we kind of glossed over this actually, Rupert. Let's go back up. It's kind of connected to the rise of the 493, and speculation has increased significantly over the last 5 days around not just a quarter of a point reduction. I think everybody's agreed that we're going to get a reduction in the Fed funds rate. I think it's something now 63% odds are of a 0.5% reduction in the Fed funds rate. Why this is relevant? Hey, broadly speaking, interest rates go down, goes up. Personally, I think it's going to be a little bit different this time around, but that's generally what happens. And so the market is primed to think that we're going back to what we saw maybe in 2021 and to the moon. But what's your take, firstly, on the Fed funds rate? What is the US Fed going to do? And how do you think that's going to affect markets?
I think they'll go 25 because I think there's still a little bit too much happening in the services area. There was an interesting survey that I listened to yesterday from Bank of America where they went and surveyed all of their business banking clients, and they've got like 40% market share. So this is a big sample size. Businesses talked about on average last 12 months, they've put through a 12% price increase, which feels pretty high, right? And so I guess I think there probably is still a bit of inflationary pressure there, despite the recent data and what it says. It's kind of, to my mind, I think the Fed will take the lower risk strategy, which is 25 basis points here. I don't think they necessarily need to do more. I do find it really interesting though, right? Because I actually have no idea how the market's going to react, because on one hand, 25 basis point cut, you sit there and go, cool. That indicates the economy is in really good health. So we started on the 493, it's a combination of an interest rate story and an economic outlook story. And 25 basis points means the economic outlook story is really, really strong. However, investors priced in the 50 basis points, and therefore that kind of a slightly slower track of reductions might actually be seen as a negative. On the flip side though, if they go 50 points, I think you can only really justify 50 points if you believe the economy is slowing pretty markedly. And you're back to that question of, actually, are we really hitting soft landing, or is the soft kind of getting a little bit harder and harder? So, but the flip side, though, is, hey, back to the moon, because kind of interest rates are going to head back to that kind of 3-3.5% a whole lot sooner. And I think that's the bit that I'm personally struggling with when I think about what's going to happen in the market moving forward. The traditional argument around actually interest rates are coming down because of the interest rates are coming down because of economic slowdown. Recession is not generally good for markets. Economic slowdown's never really good for markets. There's, hey, we're in a slightly weird world where low interest rates is good and just bumps up asset prices. And so I constructed an argument around all of those kind of both of those scenarios where both of them look really good. Both of them look really bad. It's not a game that I would want to be kind of placing a bet on, to be honest, because I think it could very easily fall anyway.
And it's interesting. Like, there's just so many holes in the whole story around rates and how they affect markets, because the underlying assumption is that the economy is running hot, which is causing the inflation, for we need high interest rates to bring down inflation. Whereas in reality, the policy by the central bank in the first place, in my view, that caused the inflation. And so if they reduce the interest rate, then I guess they might be forced into confessing how things really work and that they themselves have been responsible for it. Because if they reduce things too far and inflation takes off again and the economy craters, that say about things, right?
I personally, I think they will go the safer option. And I'm not quite sure how markets react to that, right?
Well, it will. Like we both got it wrong in terms of calling the reduction in the official cash rate here in New Zealand. And you're saying 0.25. So just for variety, I'm going to say 0.5 will be the reduction, just so one of us is right. So we retain some credibility. Hey, diversification works. Actually, tying it back to New Zealand, There's a fantastic website. I don't know how often if you use this yourself, Rupert, but GDP Live. Have you come across GDP Live?
I have. I've spent a bit of time on GDP Live.
It's amazing. So 2.5% reduction here in October when we have the official cash rate announcement. That's currently what it's predicting, I think. Well, that was the last time I checked a couple of days ago. It might have changed since then. It is live. But your view in New Zealand this time around, where we sit today, do you feel like we're going to see a 0.25% reduction in the official cash rate here in New Zealand? Or could we actually see a bigger move?
See a bigger move.
You're going to go in the bigger camp. Okay.
Yeah, I'm in the camp of, I think if I looked at the GDP Live data, I've seen that in the last probably quarters, GDP has actually come in weaker than what is expected. And we've seen consistently over the last 6 to 9 months, it continues to come in weaker than expected. I think the RBNZ is kind of aware of that. And I think the economy is kind of cratering. Like, let's be honest, there's kind of in a pretty weak space. And we've got in the worst GDP per capita basis. We're worse than where we were during the GFC. Immigration is slowed according to the initial figures. They told me the other day, you can't even record official immigration numbers that well anymore because we no longer do departure cards. So I only suspect and believe that the immigration numbers will be revised negative, so there'll be more people leaving. And so, yeah, so I personally, I think we saw in August was the first step of this, and it was kind of that broad acknowledgement that the economy was a lot weaker than everyone thought. And I just see that trend continuing, right? That we've got record numbers of insolvencies, unemployment ticking up. You talk to anyone that does anything in terms of retail, hospo, those businesses are dead. The economy really needs a shot in the arm. And I think that will be, that's kind of why I do believe it will be 50 points.
Yeah, we get there in the end anyway, right? Like we do get a flush out every now and then. We do get cycles of boom times and bust times. It flushes out things that are unproductive, dead zombie companies. Thankfully, that does happen every now and then. And I say thankfully, not because I like people suffering, but because for a natural free market to actually exist, you need to have good times and bad times. But when you intervene to try and stop those bad times, like what we saw in March 2020, it could cause way more problems that we have to deal with later on. We missed our last topic because we're over time. Yeah, but yeah, it's going to be a good topic because we're going to have another week to think about it. It's going to be great. Rupert, I hope everything's going well in your world, and we'll see you again another week.
Thanks, Darcy. That was awesome, and see you next week.
Cheers.